This is day four of this November 2015 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of 16th century Chinese Zen master Zibo from the book called Zibo, the Last Great Zen Master of China, translated by J.C. Cleary. This entry is called Entering Through the Senses. With one mind unborn, being and nothingness are not in opposition, much less is there a perceiver. One mind unborn. In this realm of one mind, we can't really speak about a birth or death. We can't speak about creation or destruction. This is what unborn means. It's beyond any such categories, beginnings, ends. It's not in the realm of time as we know it. It's the eternal. And in that realm, also, terms like being and nothingness, or existence and non-existence, that's the usual pairing of these two opposites. Being and nothingness are also not in opposition because they aren't. No such thing. No such concepts. This is just the mind beyond concepts. Before consciousness arises. He continues, even so, once one mind is born, the six sense faculties are already provided. It is not possible to have entry into enlightenment by abandoning these. Therefore, when the perfected people expound the teaching, they may explain it with the tongue, so that it can be entered via the ears, or they may explain it with the body, so that it can be entered via the eye. Using these and all the sense faculties, according to the surroundings, they open up its subtlety. Without constant pattern, they take in its marvel. This is Cleary. Sometimes he gets pretty opaque in the words he chooses as translations. Without constant pattern, they take in its marvel. Even the term the perfected people, that's not a term I've ever heard used about, if he's referring to the Buddhas, the enlightened ones. I can, this thing about the six sense faculties, it's not possible to awaken by abandoning these. Well, how could we abandon these? How could we abandon sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought? I have Roshi Kaplow's words, echoing in my mind, our true nature is beyond the six senses, but not separate from them. He continues, this being so, all things are the marks of the Tathagata's long, broad tongue. There's a footnote here. The Tathagata's, Tathagata is just another word for the Buddha. The Tathagata's long, broad tongue. Originally, this was one of the 32 auspicious marks of the Buddha. But then this came to be taken in a broader sense as symbolic of the universality an infinite multiformity of the teaching of enlightenment. The 32 marks of a Buddha always got past me. Certainly, but these are supposed to be specific physical marks that you're supposed to have if you're a Buddha. Long earlobes. I can't remember them. I never cared to try to remember them. So, this being so, all things are the marks of the Tathagata's long, broad tongue. You could put it this way. All things are manifestations of the Dharma. And then he ticks off a few of them. Sad songs, deep feelings, swearing and chiding, thorn forests and trees of beauty, gowns and caps, rites and music, drums and flutes, drinking, eating, sex, right and wrong, good and evil, the clash of weapons, the formal dance, silent misty forests, noisy urban squares. This is what is so endlessly fascinating to me about worldly things, the ways of the world, that they're all, in their own way, each thing is a manifestation of this Dharma. It has to be. Sports, fashion, every kind of fad, every kind of political event, posturing, maneuvering, inventions of every kind. It's all there. It's all somehow, in its own way, a manifestation of this Dharma. And then he says, whether one has entry or does not, in other words, whether you're awakened or not, depends on how one hears Buddha's tongue in all these forms. In other words, how we understand in all these things the Dharma. There are three characteristics of the Dharma. This is one of these basic points of doctrine, like the Four Noble Truths or the Noble Eightfold Path. The three characteristics of existence are impermanence, no self, and suffering. So look at all these examples, or any other one, anything you can imagine, any phenomenon reflects these three characteristics: impermanence, change, flux, no self. That is, everything is the product of causes and conditions that are shifting and coming together and coming apart, and suffering. Every day, open the paper, log on to whatever your news source is, you see these three. You see the Dharma. Here's the next entry is about discipline in the broad sense of upright conduct. Food and sex are the great desires of human beings. Therefore, if people can curb the great desires, then they can be told about the path of supreme enlightenment. But the great desires are harder to control than poisonous dragons or wild tigers. Accordingly, near the end of his life, the Buddha was asked by Ananda, "After the Buddha's demise, what can the monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen take as their teacher?" The Tathagata commanded, "After my decease, all those who are my disciples should take the comprehensive discipline of being liberated from all attachments as your teacher." Being liberated from all attachments, the translator has here what this means. This is in parentheses, pratimoksha. Pratimoksha is the monastic rules and regulations, or we could say even beyond monasticism. It's the, for us as lay people, it's the precepts or the codes of upright conduct. "If you can do this, then it will be no different from when I was staying in the world." That's because, as many of you have heard, these precepts delineate, and if you understood correctly, the precepts delineate the functioning of our enlightened nature. So if we can cleave to these precepts, if we can uphold them, then our true nature is functioning in its purity. And he says, "Viewing things according to this, since we are Buddha's disciples, how could we dare not to uphold pratimoksha? These days we are far from the time of Buddha. It is not only the monks in remote hideaways who do not follow methods of discipline. Even in famous Buddhist monasteries, they don't know what pratimoksha is. How sad." And so we have, coming up later this month, we have Jukai, receiving the precepts. It's a great way to embody this description of our true nature, formally allowed in the ceremony. Even I am a little surprised at how meaningful it continues to be after all these years that I've been doing it, that each time in that ceremony, it's so powerful, so meaningful to yet again take these precepts as a way of recommitting to this Dharma nature of ours, way of aligning ourselves again with what is most true and noble in us as an intention to actualize what we already are, really, to live up to what we already are. He continues, "When one's mind is pure and clean, the root of discipline is fundamentally cleansed. When one's mind is empty and still, the water of concentration is fundamentally cleared. When one's mind is thoroughly illuminated, the light of wisdom is round and full." In case you didn't pick out these three key words here, these are the three, sometimes called the three essentials of Buddhism. He translates them as discipline, concentration, and wisdom. discipline is sometimes translated as morality. The original word, the Indian word for discipline, as it is meant here, is Shila, S-I-L-A. Shila means moral conduct, morality, discipline. Concentration is the original word is dhyana, from which the word Zen comes. Dhyana became Chan, and then it went to Japan and became Zen. I think of it as meditation. And the third, wisdom is prajna wisdom. It doesn't mean book learning. It doesn't mean knowledge, but it means transcendental wisdom. So let me just read that again. When one's mind is pure and clean, the root of discipline is fundamentally cleansed. When one's mind is empty and still, the water of concentration or meditation is fundamentally cleared. When one's mind is thoroughly illuminated, the light of wisdom is round and full. Concentration or meditation can be seen in one sense. These terms are used a little differently in different contexts, but let's for the moment think of concentration as samadhi. Concentration, meditation, samadhi, sometimes they go together. And look at what the difference between samadhi or concentration or absorption, between that and wisdom, prajna wisdom, or awakening. Samadhi is it means the merging or the fusion of subject and object. That is, with the person concentrating and the object being concentrated on. So, the self and mu becoming just mu. And that state of absorption we call samadhi is a kind of it's an illuminated awareness, but that's different from awakening, the experience, the turning about in the mind of awakening. It's the precondition for awakening. So in our practice, in session or out, we don't have to give a single thought to awakening, just to become absorbed in the practice. This is the most we can do, really. It's all we have control over, is to find a way to reach a samadhi, an absorption with our practice, beyond thought, beyond all dichotomies. And the rest is out of our hands. It really becomes a matter of our karma, how ripe our karma is, as to whether that state of illuminated awareness, or samadhi, gives rise to awakening. And this is not to say, though, that if we think that we're in a pretty deep place that we call a kind of samadhi, that our job is done, because there are different degrees of samadhi. Our true samadhi is very, very unusual. It's rare, maybe too strong a word, but however absorbed we think we are, that we can't ever become complacent and rest in that. He continues, a moment of neglect and what we call inherent discipline, concentration, and wisdom are lost in delusion and become craving, anger, and ignorance. he's weaving in here all these big classifications of Buddhist doctrine. So besides the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path, then there are these three essentials that we just went through. The three characteristics of existence that I injected. And then this is the other big one that most of you know, greed, anger, and delusion, which are translated here as craving, anger, and ignorance. So to repeat that, a moment of neglect and what we call these three essentials, Shila, Dhyana, and Prajna, are lost in delusion and become greed, anger, and delusion. From then on, from birth to death, from death to birth, death after death, birth after birth, they are wrapped up continuously in the web of their deeds, rising and falling without constancy, wearing scales or shells or feathers or fur, a deva's cap or a human's clothes. He's talking here about the different realms of unenlightened existence that we evolve and devolve through until enlightenment. The myriad kinds of suffering and pleasure are all called ignorance. Thus the saying, if you submissively follow ignorance, you fall into the various states of being. If you do not submissively follow, the states of being are cut off. This being so, then ignorance and wisdom are like one and the same finger being curled up or extended. So how then do we not submissively follow ignorance? Well, we don't submit to our thoughts. That's where it starts. Submitting to our thoughts, feeding our thoughts. We refrain from trafficking in our thoughts if we can detach from our thoughts. And this is not submitting to ignorance. And this is what purifies our karma. He continues, what I get all comes from my own mind. How could I be using some other power? It depends on whether or not the person in question is willing. If they themselves actually agree to develop the mind of enlightenment, even very ignorant people who just know to drink when thirsty, eat when hungry, and feel attracted to the opposite sex, once they achieve the willing mind, then they can use this to discover that body does not exist and mind is only a name. Willing. I love that word, willing. Are you willing, when you notice that you've drifted into thought, are you willing, do you have the will to turn your attention back to your practice? That's it, right there. On that hinges our evolution, our spiritual evolution or not. Are you willing, when you notice the mind in thought, to turn back? To the practice you're working on. The trouble is that, let's be honest, a lot of people are not willing. They're not willing when they catch themselves with their mind having wandered. They're not willing to just let go and get back to the practice. At least they're not willing right away. They want to stay there, linger in those thoughts, maybe pursue them a little further, sift through them a bit more, fantasize a bit more, dwell in past and future memories and plans, that this is a sign of unwillingness. He continues, when we are liberated in respect to body and mind, adverse and favorable situations and all the myriad differences all emit the light of our own mind. At this point, there is no place to put wisdom, much less ignorance. That is, in this light of this everywhere equal mind, as we read yesterday, then such terms as wisdom and ignorance no longer apply. Continues, thus do I know that there are no ignorant people or wise people. It's just a matter of whether or not they develop the mind willing to realize enlightenment. Thus, even knowledgeable people, if they have not developed the willing mind, are no different from oxen or horses. Zen Master Dogen said, the Dharma is abundantly inherent in each individual. Yet without practice, it will not be manifested, and without enlightenment, it will not be perceived. So it's by practicing this, returning our attention to the practice we're working on, by doing that, working at it, working the will, developing that muscle called the will to turn to this no mind that we call the breath or the mu or what am I or what is. That's it. The next letter is to, it says at the end, he wrote to a man who is sick. And the translator calls this the value of adversity. The workings of mind have no constancy. Controlling them is up to the person. If you control mind with the power of the path, you do not pay attention to success and profit. Let's just stop there. Controlling the mind is misleading. Our job in Zazen is not to control it. It's to allow it to settle, to allow the mind to settle. Controlling the mind suggests that we're tinkering with the mind, that we're trying to do something to the mind. There's nothing we need to do to the mind. We just need to not dwell in our thoughts and bring our attention to what is beyond thought, this no mind. That's different from controlling the mind. And that means, when he says do not pay attention to success and profit, well, on the mat, it means don't concern yourself with how you're doing. That's not part of our job description in Zazen, to try to evaluate how we're doing, how we're doing now, how we're doing compared to this morning, yesterday, how we're doing compared to the person on our right or our left. That's all a huge waste of time, paying attention to what we imagine to be our success in our practice or our failure. But in a broader, I think he may also be meaning in when he says, do not pay attention to success and profit, I think he also may mean worldly success, job success, earning, your earning power. And so he says, if you control mind by means of success and profit, you do not pay attention to humanity and righteousness. Tracing back what they start from, though they proceed differently, neither the power of the path nor success and profit is beyond one's own mind. The divergence is in what the will is placed on, where we place our attention. Do we do we devote ourselves to success and profit, or devote the mind to this, what is beyond that, the practice? Now, of course, for householders, you have to pay enough attention to your job and you have enough money to support yourself and your family. But this is different. This is what your aspiration is. How much time do you need to dedicate to advancing in your job or making more money? When he says the divergence is in what the will is placed on, it means attention. That's what here, what will means, attention. So we have these wonderful words of the Spanish philosopher José Ortega y Gasset, who says, tell me to what you pay attention and I'll tell you who you are. He continues, when the power of the path, or the way, I like the way better than the path, the Tao, the Dharma, when the power of the way controls the mind, everything is a stepping stone, even being robbed and mistreated. When success and profit control the mind, everything is a cause for alarm, even glory and honor. When causes of alarm disturb the mind, the spirit is always troubled, all the more so when one is robbed or mistreated. Thus a person treading the path, the way, considers it the best luck to be in unwished-for situations. If one does not awaken amidst this great good luck, but rather floats along pursuing objects, this is called dimming the mind. A person whose mind is dimmed, even if in daily contact with sages, is no different from a blind man who thinks it's the dead of night even though the bright sun is above his head. Generally, if you just don't deceive mind, mind of itself is luminous and wise. They're the words of the Buddha. They're so profound. He said, this mind is bright and self-luminous, but it is stained by adventitious defilements. This mind, our true mind, that we all share equally, is bright and self-luminous. But the stains, the things that make us unhappy, are these adventitious defilements. Adventitious means defilements that are not inherent to our nature, but just come and go. Using the luminous and wise mind, when you are placed in unwished-for situations, they are like remnants of snow naturally melting away in spring. It doesn't take crashing thunder splitting the earth open to disperse them. This statement, thus a person treading the way considers it the best luck to be in unwished for situations. It's a kind of a stretch to how many people would consider it the best luck, except through some reflection. When we have time to reflect, and often that means in retrospect, after the thing happens, and we look back, then we can see how powerful it was to advance us spiritually, not to get what we want, to suffer misfortune. Now he quotes a Confucian or a Chinese classic, the Book of Poetry. The stone of another mountain can be used to cut jade. And then he explains, if you use jade to cut jade, forming a vessel is exceedingly difficult because both are smooth and rubbing them together has no effect. Thus, when you are placed in a desirable situation, mind and situation are both forgotten. Since you forget, you lose awareness. So when everything is going just smoothly, no pain, then this is not propitious for real spiritual work. Remember, the first of the Four Noble Truths is life is suffering. Suffering is pervasive, and that's the springboard into practice. That's how we go beyond ourselves and evolve. Who would want to change anything, oneself or anything, when all is just smooth and easy, comfortable and pleasurable? Like jade, rubbing against jade, everything is smooth. And this is our particular misfortune in the United States and other highly developed, consumer-rich countries, is our fortune. Our fortune is our misfortune spiritually, because there's a complacency. There is not the feeling of needing to change. There isn't the spur of dukkha. The Dalai Lama put it very simply and clearly. America has perfected samsara. And then he says, thus it is said, adverse situations are a spear in your face, favorable situations are an arrow in the back of your head. And then he explains, the spear in your face, meaning in front of you, is easy to dodge. The arrow in the back of your head is hard to defend against. I'm going to close with a story from this great source of stories called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart. And this is by a physician, a true story. It's kind of simple, but really quite moving in its own way, especially because it's a true story. He says that he had come into his practice A young man had come in to see him with bone cancer. His leg was removed at the hip to save his life. He was 24 years old, and when the physician started working with him, he was a very angry man with a lot of bitterness. He felt a deep sense of injustice and a very deep hatred for all well people, because it seemed so unfair to him that he had suffered this terrible loss so early in life. The physician says, I worked with this man through his grief and rage and pain using painting, imagery, and deep psychotherapy. After working with him for more than 2 years, there came a profound shift. He began coming out of himself. Later, he started to visit other people who had suffered severe physical losses, and he would tell me the most wonderful stories about these visits. I'm going to skip a paragraph here. It was a year following this that we sat down to review our work together. He talked about what was significant to him, and then I shared what was significant in our process. As we were reviewing our 2 years of work together, I opened his file and there discovered several drawings he had made early on. I handed them to him. He looked at them and said, "Oh, look at this." He showed me one of his earliest drawings. I had suggested to him that he draw a picture of his body. He had drawn a picture of a vase, and running through the vase was a deep black crack. This was the image of his body, and he had taken a black crayon and had drawn the crack over and over again. He was grinding his teeth with rage at the time. It was very, very painful because it seemed to him that this vase could never function as a vase again. It would never hold water. Now, several years later, he came to this picture and looked at it and said, "Oh, this one isn't finished." And I said, extending the box of crayons, "Why don't you finish it?" He picked a yellow crayon, and putting his finger on the crack, he said, "You see here where it's broken? This is where the light comes through." And with the yellow crayon, he drew light streaming through the crack in his body. This is someone with the good karma to be able to transform a terrible loss into something completely different. And it just goes to the point that Zeebo is making, that would he have evolved in that way spiritually without that terrible misfortune? Does anyone take the next step in their spiritual evolution except from some, at the very least, some dissatisfaction, pain? The first of the Four Noble Truths. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.